This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
This conversation between legal scholar Brian Socek and philosopher Jonathan Gilmore has been organized to coincide with Cabinet's publication of Socek's book, Permitting Art, Visual Arts, and the First Amendment on the Streets of New York. The book is the first volume in a new series we are launching titled Art Before the Law. The format of this series is simple. Each volume will present primary documents from a court case, or several related ones if relevant, where an important issue in the field of art has been raised, debated, and crucially adjudicated during the course of a trial. These documents will be accompanied by an in-depth essay that will contextualize the particular artistic and legal entanglements of the case in question. The goal of the series, which will encompass court cases from various countries across the last 150 years, is more complicated. As an ensemble, it hopes to make a contribution toward the project of mapping the history of the relationship between law and aesthetic modernity, encounters that have crystallized many of the latter's defining concerns, including the questions of authorship and authenticity, the source of the authority to interpret, the parameters of criticism, and art's relationship to the public. In presenting in detail the arguments laid out in court, this series will examine the interpretations that were available and acceptable at the time, and how these interpretations related to or placed into question the operative assumptions governing both the production and reception of art in modernity.
Thank you. Thank you all for turning out. So I thought I would just go through four moments in the story that gets told in this book. I'm not going to dwell on the details of the law so much as the things that I found most important along the way, to give everybody who's here, who presumably hasn't read this, a common knowledge of just what happened that then can be the basis of our discussion. So moment one, 1993, around at least 100 artists were arrested in New York City, for visual artists, for selling their work on the streets. The backstory is that in 1977, the city council had divided vending into two different types. There was food vending, regulated one particular way, and there was everything else. In 1979, the everything else category ended up with, they allotted 853 permits citywide, and that has never changed. So to this day, that's the number of people that can sell, with one big exception. Veterans, honorably discharged veterans, need a permit, but they aren't subject to the cap. The other big exception, which came in 1982, was that vendors of so-called written matter did not need a permit. So, this was people selling books, people selling newspapers, people selling baseball cards, but not people selling maps. The city got in the business of deciding what kinds of written matter seemed like a tool, like a map, versus a form of communication, like apparently a baseball card. Calendars were in the no category there. So fast forward to 1993, when the visual artists are getting arrested. A character who reappears throughout this book, Robert Lederman, was arrested at least 40 times in this period. He founded an organization of artists that, to this day, he continues, I'm on his mailing list, advocating for the rights of artists on the streets of New York. He and a different artist, Robert Berry, B-E-R-Y, each filed separate lawsuits in 1994. Those got combined. There were others involved in the suits too, but those were the named plaintiffs. Berry is the one that the case ended up taking the name of, and it ended up in front of a district court judge in the Southern District here, Miriam Goldman Sederbaum, who went on to be famous for adjudicating the rights of Martha Graham's dances. She also had another Martha case. She sentenced Martha Stewart to her time in prison. But more relevantly to what we're talking about, before this, she for a long time had been general counsel of MoMA. And so some question when the case arrives there of, does this mean she's a friend of artists, or does this mean she's a friend of museums, to which these street vendors could be seen as a kind of, not quite competitor with MoMA, but certainly not what she was in the business of protecting. It turned out more the latter. She released an incredibly unsympathetic opinion to their claims that were brought both under the First Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause, more or less the same kind of claims either way. On the First Amendment, it's saying you're discriminating based on content, the type of art that it is. In the equal protection side, you're discriminating based on speaker, you know, so a painter over here, an author over here. More or less the same claim. And here's what she had to say. Sederbaum claims, let's read a little bit here, that the city exempts only written matter because, quote, written matter is the heartland of the First Amendment. Because art is further from the core than the written word, the city's decision to exempt sellers of written matter cannot be seen as irrational. The crucial premise here, which Sederbaum offers no citation to support, is the idea that, quote, items bearing words, quoting from her, items bearing words that express political or religious views are much closer to the heartland of First Amendment protection of speech than the apolitical paintings in these cases. At one point in her opinion, Sederbaum grudgingly recognizes, quote, some expressive content in fine works of art, but only, again quoting, just as there is in the decorative work of a silversmith. Later, she compares the plaintiff's desire to sell their art to a public school teacher's refusal to wear a tie, something more conduct than speech. Both might express some vague sentiments without, quote, carrying either words or the particularized social and political messages upon which the First Amendment places special value. And as I said, this is an especially grudging opinion. Later in all the cases to follow, the word myopic keeps reappearing and causes some controversy at the Second Circuit, which sees it as a discriminatory term. They try to get it taken out of the opinion. But the point here is the traditional rationales for the First Amendment actually do fit quite awkwardly with visual arts. So, for example, the marketplace of ideas doesn't have a clear analog to the kinds of things that Lederman and Barry were selling. The idea that speech is protected because it's a necessity for democratic self-governance also can sometimes fit awkwardly. Harry Calvin, the First Amendment scholar, once wrote, quote, the people do not need paintings or poems because they will be called upon to vote. The other traditional rationale for free speech protections is that the idea that art is an important means of self-development or personal fulfillment, but it seems that would be just as true for the silversmith, for a whittler, for a fisherman, you know, for anybody that has a hobby, as it would be for a visual artist. So just to say that although she was controversially unprotective of the visual arts, there's a long tradition of grappling with the question of why it is that the First Amendment should apply to non-representational art, at least, at all. Okay, that's moment one. Moment two, there's an appeal. So as the case goes from the district court to the Second Circuit, it attracts some amicus briefs, friends of the court, and some powerful ones. On the side of the city, the business improvement districts start to weigh in. And they say that visual art, contrasted with written material, which is which they described as characteristically informative, visual art people purchase because of, quote, its aesthetic appeal or economic value, rather than because of its content. New York City went even further in its brief, saying, quote, as merchandise, there is essentially no distinction between a t-shirt, a mug, a leather belt, a necklace, a vase, a knitted hat or sweater, and a painting. So that's the one side. On the other side, we had both the brief that was published here by a collection of very prominent artists, art historians and scholars, several museums, all banded together to have the Amicus Brief, which has never been reprinted, and so that's one of the contributions, I'd say, of this book. And my favorite point that they make, given that the other side has argued that art should be valued less because it doesn't have this kind of cognitive representational material in it, they say, you know what, they point out the extent to which the Supreme Court has protected the non-cognitive side, the emotional side of words, where the key case there is Cohen v. California, which you may know as the fuck the draft case, in case where somebody shows up in a leather jacket in a court, says fuck the draft on the back, he gets arrested, and the Supreme Court protects it, saying words are often chosen as much for their emotive as their cognitive force. So really turning that argument against the distinction being made on the other side. The ACLU also came in at the appeal and had some incredibly powerful arguments. First, they said that the district court had forgotten that what it needed to analyze is, even when you have a content-neutral regulation of speech, which this was said to be, and we'll argue whether that's the case, but even there, you have to provide adequate alternative forums for speech. And the ACLU said, these street vendors don't have that. The city said, sure they do. The vending law only prevented people from selling art on the sidewalks. You could just display it on the sidewalk and sell it later. You could sell it on the internet. You could sell it elsewhere in a gallery. And the ACLU said, first, most of these artists don't have access to galleries. And second, and this is the crucial point, I think, they say, private gallery shows do not serve the same expressive purpose as street vending. Artists like Barry and Letterman were not just selling their expression on the street. Selling on the street was itself part of what they were trying to express. A quote from the brief, this is the ACLU, a primary reason for selling on the street is to engage in discussion with the audience. The very act of selling art in public spaces communicates a message of being a free spirit and creating expressive works outside the construct of society. In other words, the selling of the art was part of the message of the work itself. And that's a message, that's an argument that landed with the Second Circuit. So when it got to the Court of Appeals, there were three judges, only one sitting full-time on the court, one was retired, had taken senior status, and then they do a thing they often do is to drag a judge from the district court to sit by designation. And in this case, it was Robert Carter, the civil rights icon, who had argued Brown v. Board of Education, who had succeeded Thurgood Marshall as general counsel of the NAACP. And fascinatingly, in the opinion that Judge Carter goes on to write, instead of just citing the standard kind of art cases, art law cases, First Amendment cases, he cites cases about music, two rulings about civil rights marches, and one that's an example of a sit-in at a segregated library. And if you think about what those cases, especially that last one does, is it brings up a case about expression where, of course, the place of the expression, the sit-in at the library, is, of course, the very content of what's being expressed. So this is a person that was extremely sympathetic to this as an argument. And in fact, he goes on to say, street marketing is in fact a part of the message of appellant's art. As they note, they believe art should be available to the public. Anyone, not just the wealthy, should be able to view it and to buy it. Artists are part of the real world, he puts in quotes. They struggle to make a living and interact with their environments. The sale of art in public places conveys these messages. So because of that, he was able to say that any of the other types of allegedly adequate alternatives for sale, like galleries, internet, wouldn't have been adequate at all, and he found for the artists. Third moment. The case then goes back to the district court, where the city and the plaintiffs, the artists in this case, have to negotiate a consent decree. What is the city going to do going forward? Given that the Court of Appeals has just held that artists have a right to sell their visual art on the streets of New York. In the cases, there had been represented photographers, painters, printmakers, and sculptors. So, this is where a very strange thing happens. the language of basically what happens when they go and produce the consent decree, instead of painters selling their paintings, it says that paintings can be sold on the street without without a permit. Photographs, prints, sculpture, everything about artists selling their own work, which had been the basis of the Second Circuit's opinion, vanishes. The language of the consent decree suggests that it follows the appellate court's opinion, which the consent decree says found unconstitutional the application of city law to vendors who sell paintings, photographs, prints, and or sculpture. But the Second Circuit had not done that at all. It literally had said, quote, the city's requirement that appellants be licensed in order to sell their artwork in public spaces is unconstitutional. So what happened, well, it turns out this Robert Lederman, who I keep mentioning, was just dead set on trying to negotiate that it be paintings, that it be photographs. And he had two reasons. One, he from the very beginning had said, we visual artists should have the same rights that the written matter exception, the people that are subject to that exception have. So you can sell other people's books. That didn't just apply to people that had written the articles in the newspaper. You can sell any newspaper. He thought visual artists should have the same right, because after all, he was against the difference between those two art forms, the way that they were being treated in law. Secondly, he didn't want to give the city the power, as it has in certain other areas, to decide who's a painter, who's a photographer, you know, somebody who qualifies for that. And he stuck to his guns, and the city agreed, which is why when you walk down city streets, most of the art you see here is not actually work that is made by the artist. You know, it's mass-produced photographs of the Empire State Building or some such thing, all because of the consent decree that came out of Barry. That's the third moment. The fourth and final moment, fast forward 10 years, and we have two more artists who have been arrested. Christopher Mastrovincenzo and Kevin Santos, both trained artists, although they both worked in what they described as a graffiti style. Mastrovincenzo had gone to Pratt, Santos had gone to Fordham, they had both had shows, and in fact, the success that they had had in the traditional artwork, in the traditional art world, came back to bite them a bit. So they were making two arguments when they were arrested. They had a graffiti style and would paint on hats and shirts and sell those on the street. They got arrested saying, no, those are hats and shirts, not paintings, and they brought a case. Notably, their case was not represented by people that primarily do art law and freedom of expression law. It was represented by people who mostly do street vending law. And I think that will come back in just a second. So Mastrovincenzo and Santos have basically two arguments. One is a kind of contract type argument. There's this contract that says paintings can be sold on city streets. It said, we do paintings. What we do just fits that word. The second argument in the alternative is, even if that's not true, even if we're some independent type of art, some, you know, sui generis type of art, we should be independently protected under the First Amendment. And the problem was, one of their problems, was that those two arguments kind of worked against each other. Because to show that they were painting, in the meaning of the contract, they were really talking up their bona fides, you know, their art world bona fides. We've had all these gallery shows. There was a documentary done about one of them. Look, they brought in a bunch of experts to show, yes, graffiti is a recognized form of painting. All of that then worked against their argument in the First Amendment claim, which, remember, the problem is, do you have an alternative, adequate alternative forum? Well, sure. You just said you have documentaries made about you. You've got gallery shows. The court was able to say over there, looks like you're doing just fine and you don't need to sell on the street. So their arguments were in tension. When it got to the Second Circuit, this time it was a less friendly judge, Jose Cabranes, almost made it to the Supreme Court twice under Clinton, Justice Sotomayor's, she was his protege, but she ended up beating him to be the first Puerto Rican justice. He joined the court as a 39-year-old, you know, this prodigy. He writes this quite caustic opinion that says, first, just this isn't painting. You know, this isn't what the city agreed to when it agreed to this. We can just think, what do we think they meant when they signed this agreement? They meant painting. They meant something on a canvas. This is not that. That was argument one. Two, should it get independent First Amendment protection? Well, there he said, it doesn't fall into one of the four categories that we've recognized. Actually, here the silversmith comes back. Because they say, going forward, we have certain categories, certain mediums of art that are categorically protected. Painting, sculpture, photography, print. Then there's others that could be expressive. The work of the jeweler or the silversmith. And then there's things that's just merchandise. For that middle, he comes up with a test. And he says, one thing we're not going to do is ask the artist whether their work is expressive or not. We're going to look at the work itself. If an item, here I'm quoting, possesses expressive elements, consider whether it has non-expressive or useful elements as well. It's a shirt after all. Determine if the expressive elements predominate. Was the expressive content simply added to ordinary merchandise to circumvent city licensing requirements? Just spray paint on a regular t-shirt? That was me, not it. Back to it. Does the expressive version of a product, like a hat, cost significantly more than unadorned versions of the same object? The only thing that he didn't look at, besides talking to the artist, is looking at the artist's resume, which the district court had done. He said, we don't care that you went to Pratt. We look at the object itself. And on that test, he said, yes, these are a new category of expressive objects, these graffiti hats and shirts. And yet they're not exempted from the vendor laws. Why? Because here he thought this balancing test where we look at how important are the city's governmental interest in regulating in this way, how readily are there alternative avenues for them to express themselves. He said that balancing test comes out differently in the Master Vincenzo graffiti hats and shirts than it did in the Barry canvas paintings. And one of the main reasons, aside from what I already said about they've got their gallery shows and all that, was the difficulty that beat cops are going to have walking down the street and making judgments of, is this a painting on a hat, or is this just a painted hat? That kind of distinction in this sort of middle ground medium that it's neither here nor there, would be so hard to do, to administer, that the city has a reason for requiring a permit in this kind of case. So Master Vincenzo and Santos lost where Barry had won. I'll stop there, except to say that I'm sure we can follow up on this, but I started writing this feeling quite condescending about the Master Vincenzo opinion. This idea that this isn't, there's a dissent in there, it's 2-1, there's a dissent that says, give me a break. Not all paintings on canvas. Have you ever seen a fresco? It's very easy to make fun of the opinion in that regard as having a overly old-fashioned vision. And over time, I've increasingly come around to a medium-specific vision of First Amendment protections. Not for art, that's why the article that Sina talked about is called The Constitutional Irrelevance of Art. I think that the category art, the umbrella category, has never done any work in any Supreme Court case law in the United States, whereas medium-specific protections have done a great deal of work and are incredibly important. And I've come to think that that's actually the right answer. Whether that's the right answer in New York, certainly whether New York's vending laws are what we would ever create, were we starting afresh? I think it's very unlikely. Instead, they've accreted over time by, having carve-outs here, carve-outs there, a weird negotiation in 1995 where they gave away probably too much. But what they learned from giving away too much, instead of looking at photographers, but looking at photographs, is that medium-specific regulation actually worked very well in the city. They, before Mastro Vincenzo, they had gone 10 years without ever having a serious dispute about whether something required a permit or not. That's an amazing fact on the streets of New York, that what they had stumbled into, the test they had stumbled into, was that successfully administrable over that 10-year period. I'll stop there. Thanks again for coming, everybody.
So my role here is just to sort of shine the spotlight on Brian, okay? So I'm just going to ask you a few questions, raise some kind of, questions of my own, and you can say whatever you like in response, and then we could open up to everyone here assembled. At one point, you write, asking the government to provide special protections for the arts requires letting the government decide what is and isn't art, or what art is valuable enough to deserve those protections. And I really like that thought, because this is the sort of devil's bargain that we make when we try to appropriate the First Amendment protections for speech and expression in general to fashion some sort of protection for the arts. And I agree, and I agree mainly because I was persuaded by your article, that the Constitution doesn't really recognize the arts qua art, qua art, except for maybe in some sense of useful arts or whatever, but that's not what we're talking about here. And so you have this way in which we care about the arts, we recognize their value, and so we want some way to sort of elevate them above the ordinary stuff that gets regulated as mere commerce. And so where do we look for those protections? Well, something has to do with expression, or political expression in particular. And the interesting thing about that is that it does work to some extent, especially if the art has political content, and we can point to that because political expression is, you know, deserves a special sort of deference from the First Amendment perspective. But the danger there, of course, is that there's a whole swath of art that doesn't obviously engage in the kinds of expression that A, is political, so they're okay, it's protected, or B, is even the kind of expression that we think really warrants substantial protection, that is crucial to our lives. And so there's a way in which this may be the best that we can do. Let me ask you this. If you think this is the best we can do, reach for the First Amendment in these respects, or have we kind of, in a kind of rhetorical sleight of hand, kind of gotten protection for all these arts with respect to selling on the street or what have you, right? When in fact the protections as described really only apply to a subset of those arts. The arts that engage in these sort of First Amendment activities of, however you want to interpret it, self-government, you know, marketplace ideas, or even something like sort of self-realization. So let's start there.
There's a bigger question there of a sort of incoherence in the way we treat the First Amendment, where the central principle of the First Amendment is this idea that the government shouldn't involve in discrimination amongst content, right? So it shouldn't favor certain things, certain forms of expression over others, certainly not particular viewpoints, but also content discrimination is, you know, the thing we normally watch out for. And yet, while that's true, there's also this several lines of case law in which a certain type of content, political content, gets privileged. So if you're a government worker speaking at work and somebody's trying to fire you for it, it matters whether you are speaking on a matter of public concern or not. You know, when we're talking about privacy invasions and things like that, we look at whether somebody was looking into your private life or whether they were piercing you into some matter of public interest. There are any number of ways in which there is content discrimination built into the doctrine. And that's never been satisfactorily explained anywhere in First Amendment doctrine, much less here, where you wonder, you know, should we be dividing up art into that which is specifically helpful for, you know, self-governance versus that which isn't, that which has political content versus that which doesn't. The first time that Barry was arrested, there was a state court judge who dismissed the criminal charges against him, saying it's ridiculous that somebody could be selling something apolitical like baseball cards and be protected, whereas Barry actually did have politically themed, the first thing he was arrested for was environmentally themed artworks. So here, this guy's doing politics, the baseball card people aren't, the wrong one's protected, she dismissed the case entirely. So do we want to be doing that? I think in general, judges have made the smart decision not just to not make that distinction, but in general not to be making individualized aesthetic judgments of individual works of art when they're looking at protection or not. There are some exceptions to that. So VARA, the Visual Artists' Rights Act, what the Five Points case was about, looks at, it protects works of recognized stature. So you actually do have to look at the individual, make an individualized aesthetic judgment. But that's quite rare. As I see it, normally what we've done instead is to treat certain mediums of expression as the traditional types of mediums in which politics and other socially important expression has been waged, you know, has been done. And so we're going to underprotect some things that don't fall into that medium, but which are socially valuable. And we're going to way overprotect lots of things that are in that medium, you know, lots of books that are completely valueless, but we're going to protect because they're books. And that there is something administrable about doing it on the medium thing. And one last thing about that, about medium, is imperfect as it is, it directs our attention to differences among the arts that are most likely to be relevant to law. So the medium of architecture comes with dangers that the medium of poetry does not. Right? And so we think that the way in which poetry is dangerous is not the kind of way that government should regulate. Whereas the ways in which architecture is typically dangerous are the types of things we want government to be interested in. And so it directs the law to the right kinds of things.
Okay. So following up on that, central to a lot of these arguments, yours and in the cases themselves, is the question of to what extent, or if at all, the medium of the art or the form of the art inflects its content, yeah. Okay? The way in which the medium, in some sense, is part of its meaning or content.
Where the medium here even means selling on the street.
Selling on the street. And I thought about I realized that Lederman, he was arrested hundreds of times. Clearly being arrested, being an outlaw artist that way, is part of his art. Sure. Just the way in which for graffiti artists, painting on a surface that you do not own and for which you could be punished, right, is part of the art. It's no fun when the Brooklyn Museum invited a bunch of graffiti artists in and had them create works there on their walls in the museum, the safe space. It loses the expressive power, obviously, meaning. Now there's a sense in which all art's content is inflected by its medium. The same content, it would be wrong to say the same proposition is meaningful in the same way, whether rendered in poetry, painting, sculpture, what have you, okay? It has a different meaning insofar as it's represented in different ways, okay? And that may be even true when you translate the same proposition from one language to another, okay? But there's a more specific sense in which, for these artists, selling on the street is part of the medium, is part of the meaning. It's mm-hmm. it inflects the content. There's no independent content shorn of the mode in which it's presented to us by being sold on the street. That seems like a very slim source for protecting art being sold on the street in general, right? Yeah. Because clearly those people clogging the plaza outside the Metropolitan Museum, et cetera, they're not there to express something by virtue of selling mm-hmm. their work on the street. Mm-hmm. Does that worry you?
Yeah. It does, and it reminds me that I gave a promissory note that I didn't pay. I said that there was a difference in the lawyering between the two cases. The first case had art people, and the second one had street vending people. Mm. I forgot to tell you how that played out. In Master Vincenzo, they never brought up this argument. Mm. They never claimed that selling on the street was somehow intrinsic to the meaning of their work, which is somewhat shocking given that our association of graffiti with the street.
And it might have helped.
That is a format in which we think, that it's a type of art in which we think of place as being very heavily intrinsic to the meaning, right? Mm-hmm. Just as you said. So they didn't make that argument. So that doesn't come up in that opinion at all in a way that was potentially determinative in the first opinion. Okay, so should it have been determinative? Yeah, of course not. I mean, in a sense that in San Francisco, where I live now, we don't do it this way. We don't have a medium-based approach. We really protect small vendors, people that produce small numbers of things and do it by hand. Mm-hmm. Totally different route here. Getting at different sets of values, but not bringing in that So we do get the silversmith and the jeweler, mm-hmm. But we also have inspectors that go in and make sure that they're not mass producing it. They'll go in and surprise visit their studios. Mm-hmm. See, are you really doing the silver right there? Nobody makes the claim that the street is somehow intrinsic to the selling of that jewelry. It's not. That's something that was necessitated by the way, the corner that New York pushed them. At the same time, I am very open to the idea that, that's why I brought up Carter, Judge Carter. There are so many examples of expression in which the place truly is, just every lunch counter boycott, right?
The libraries.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The library sit-ins, where the location is just completely intrinsic to the meaning of the expression. Right. My first clerkship out of law school, my judge got the Occupy New Haven case. It was the longest standing Occupy encampment on the East Coast in the New Haven Green. You were still there then.
Lasted
forever, and
it really destroyed global capitalism.
They were a success, but the city had there made a stupid argument in their briefs. They had said, "Look, they're camping. They could just, for all we know, they're just saying that they like the outdoors." And although my judge ruled against Occupy there and made the. His opinion just had no patience for that. He said, nobody who's lived in America these last few years thinks that this encampment is about people that just love the outdoors. The placement of this, bringing this encampment, occupying the center of our cities, is intrinsic to the meaning. It's what Goodman calls exemplification, right? It's the idea that you're embodying the meaning there. You're embodying the expression. You possess the expression. And I think that plays an important role, or should, in First Amendment law, whether it does it. Of course, it was a genius argument here mm-hmm. That was probably taken for more than it's worth.
Well, factor here is that you're trying to defend a particular person with a particular art practice.
Yep.
Let people later on try and generalize to all arts if they're strategic about it and so on. But it worked for him, yeah. Or it should have worked at least for these artists.
And I will say, I think the it's not exactly a discovery, because obviously the people that were part of this litigation knew what was happening. But the part of the story that is the single most important thing is the transition from the Second Circuit opinion in Barry, photographers, painters, to the consent decree in Barry. Like, that's the thing that's reshaped New York, and that's the thing that transformed all these arguments that make a lot of sense when you're talking about Barry or Lederman, but don't make sense when you're talking about mass reproduced pictures of the John Lennon Memorial.
Right, so let me ask you about that. Two questions, and then maybe we can open it up. One is about that that shift that people didn't recognize between saying that the artists are protected or the sellers are protected, and then saying the art, the painting, whatever. Mm-hmm. I could see how that shift expresses two conflicting interpretations of the point of the First Amendment. Mm. All right. So artists, what you're doing is you're protecting something like self-realization values that we have in expressing our ideas. It matters that I express my views, not that the views happen to be expressed out there, because it's important for me to discover something about my own views, my values, my commitments, through expressing them. As we all, this happens to us, right? You don't really know what you believe until you try to articulate it, that kind of thing, or try to live the life that embodies the values. And then sometimes you discover, oh, that's not me, right? And that's one of the interpretations. It's kind of like a tertiary. It's less pronounced interpretation of First Amendment. Whereas the others are, look, the reason why we have this protection of the First Amendment protections is the marketplace of ideas. The ideas just need to be out there, and they need to be able to compete with one another so that the cream rises to the top, which, of course, we know doesn't happen, right? We just elected Trump. But the idea there is that it's not the individual players in the market. It's the ideas that we need to let free to discover, in Mill's terms, essentially, what is true, right? And what false things now can be challenged. So I wonder about that.
That's absolutely right. So the first of those is, I think, the San Francisco route that I just described, mm-hmm. that we actually don't care whether it's expressive material or not. We will allow you to self-actualize, with your small-scale jewelry production, and you can sell that on the street without a permit, and that's great. And that's the route we've taken. And the other one needs a different rationale. Yeah. And they argued it on one, and then there was a bait and switch. Absolutely. Yeah. And so, because of course, when we start with books and newspapers, we don't expect that somebody is selling their own writing all the time. We want the pamphlets out there. We have a rich tradition of getting pamphlets out there, not just somebody selling their own pamphlet.
Right. Okay, then the last, and this might be a depressing way to conclude my questions. What's really nice about your approach here is that you get into the nitty-gritty of how it is the courts are going to answer very practical concerns about the regulation of art and other forms of expression on the street. So philosophers and legal theorists can sit back and say, this should be protected, this shouldn't, or this is a good justification for the protection, this is a poor justification because it's inconsistent with, XYZ, these other values. But the rubber hits the road here. You're sympathetic to Cabranes's view in the end, right? That in some ways these questions of aesthetics need to be subordinated to the questions of the administration of aesthetics. We need some workable way to operationalize these abstract ideas that we are committed to, and we can't ask the beat cop to look at a white square and another white square and decide that the first has no content and that the second is about nothing, or something like that, right? Like
paint sample.
Yeah. And so what do? Well, let's just say paintings, prints, photography, right? Sculpture, protected, and then the other stuff.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that, or the depressing thing about that, is that it seems like it's built into this understanding that there is a kind of regressive aesthetics or a regressive approach to the arts, that it's always going to favor the tried and true traditional genres at the cost of precisely those forms of expression that promise the a capacity to say something new, mm-hmm. right? To be appropriately critical in ways we wouldn't have thought of before of our the way our society is organized or whatever the thing is you want it to be. And so it's in some sense like Plato's Republic, right? It's like, well, you know, let's organize the politics first, ideal state, and then we'll see if the arts fit within that, you know? And it seems like in Cabranes' view or that view, right? Yeah, we can pretty much handle making distinctions among painting, sculpture, and so on, so we'll accommodate those. But the rest of the stuff, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know?
I think the hardest question in the crossover work that I do and others do between law and aesthetics is to think through when we think the best thinking within aesthetics and the best thinking within the arts should be imported into the law or not. Because it's not always the case that the law should just recognize whatever, you know, the leading theory. It's not. There are any number, one, because that might not be administrable, in ways that can have profoundly harmful effects. And that's where all of the cases about exemption, this is an exemption case. This is a case not unlike a religious exemption case. It's just exemptions for arts, not for religion. It's saying the law shouldn't apply to me because I'm an artist. And there are times when we want that, just as we want it in, American law wants it in religion. And there are times where we say, no, actually, cake baker, website designer, you shouldn't be able to just turn away gays who want to get married and have your services. And you shouldn't be able to use as the reason for turning them away that your cake is an artwork, that your website is art. And it's not productive to have that be the fight. Mm-hmm. Even if I absolutely agree that there are any number of galleries in which a cake is exhibited and should be and is an artwork. Mm-hmm. Absolutely agree with that. But I don't want to, it shouldn't follow then that Masterpiece Cake Shop, that Jack Phillips should be able to turn away gays.
So if Wayne Thiebaud decided he wasn't going to paint cakes and he's going to actually make them, right?
Yep.
That you think his production could, from the standpoint of academic philosophy of art, be understood as art.
For sure.
And enjoy the protections of art.
Correct. Well.
But, or, okay.
We're going to fight what those protections are.
Okay. But it's not good for us or society, and it doesn't further our values if we allow that academic theory to be taken up by the law.
Well, I'm just not going to fetishize the term art there.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, he's made an artwork. But now if I'm mass producing art where they all look the same no matter who comes in, I've just got all these artworks. Well, now I'm just, you know, I'm just Abercrombie and Fitch, which has a whole bunch of, you know, shirts and sweaters, and yet they too are making an art claim that they have an all-encompassing theatrical experience when you walk into their store, which is why they're not going to hire black people or people that are fat.
Or Muslims wearing a veil.
Because they're giving this kind of all-encompassing experience. They're doing something theatrical. They're not doing theater, but it's theatrical. The cake is sculptural. Something is pictorial. It's musical. No. I don't think the law wants to recognize that for those kinds of purposes. Mm-hmm. So that's one, you know, the administrability problem is a real one. But the second problem, which doesn't come out quite so much here, but does in many other areas of law, is that sometimes the law is just looking at art for its own particular purposes. And so the things that the art world cares about are not the things that tariff law cares about. Tariff law is about protectionism of domestic industry. And the reason why artists at the beginning of the 20th century got rid of tariffs for imports of European art, sculpture, et cetera, is because they had a broadly Kantian idea that there's a spark of genius there that can't be replicated. So, it's not like importing foreign cars. They can't be replicated. There's no competition there. Anything we import is unique, and we'll just cultivate a spectatorship that will then, help the arts here too. Like, that was a view of art that corresponded with a aim of law. And so it's not to say, you should have a, Kantian belief in genius across the board. It's to say that actually works really well for tariff law. By contrast, your white squares, let's say that there's a copyright case that's wondering if there's substantial similarity between your two white squares. That's, one of the tests for copyright violations. There, I think you actually want to
introduce philosophy,
bring back Danto and, and explain why two white squares, there can actually be progress in the arts between two white squares.
Right.
Because the whole purpose there is progress in the arts. And so if you're able to give a convincing account, a true account, I would say, of why these two white squares are not the same object, or they don't have the same meaning, then you've done a convincing thing by copyright law's lights, by its own lights. Mm-hmm. You've given a convincing story, not just by the art world's lights, but you've reached it and said, yes, the thing you're trying to achieve, copyright law, Danto can tell you
can
why these two things aren't a violation.
Yeah, I have to admit that I'm really worried about the Amigian-specific attempt to define these things, because I've come across it in a big way in the last 2 years, where kind of asked, I've been involved in your world of art and law, and I've seen, judges just love painting, first of all. That's real art. Photography's maybe art. Collage, they seem to have decided was art as well, but things like appropriation, they just absolutely unwilling to look at. Recently, I've been involved in this Meta Birkin's case. I don't know if you know it at all. NFT digital images, which I argued at length, were something called business art, a new conceptual category done by Warhol. Judge Rakoff definitely did not want to hear about that. So there's a real problem that the most interesting art of the 20th century is exactly what judges just don't want to hear about. And it just seems incredibly primitive. I mean, when I try to follow the world of art law, it doesn't have anything to do with what I think of as art that has mattered for the last 100 years. And that seems to me a problem for First Amendment. If we're ruling out a huge amount of most important creativity, Goldsmith Warhol was really about appropriation art.
Mm-hmm.
And the Supreme Court deciding that it really wasn't relevant to distinguishing between these two artists, or at least that's part, I think, of what was underneath it. I think there's a big problem. You can't make any argument except for photography, prints, painting, and sculptures. I mean, would a urinal presented as a work of art be valid, as a work of art? My guess is that most judges today would say no, unless they allow an art historian in to make a special case for this guy on their selfish shop.
Right.
So it does seem to me there's a real problem there for ruling out protection for the most interesting art. I would argue that most paintings today are not art, in fact. That most paintings are trivial commodities like anything that could normally be sold. The fact that they're handmade marks on canvas doesn't actually give them protection.
Great. So a book-related comment and then I think more important comment. Book related, Master Vincenzo in the second case, they had a stream of experts brought in to explain to the court things like Duchamp. And that backfired on them for the precise reason that, Judge Cabranes, slightly condescending to it, is making fun of it a bit in the opinion, but basically it was like, if anything can be art, not that everything is art, but if anything can be art, then what's the beat cop to do? And that's a genuine problem.
Beat art critics, maybe?
What's that?
Beat art critics.
Yeah, we can.
But that's the problem of it. Because it's difficult to administer a regime in which anything can be art.
The problem of indiscernibles is tough for legal regulations. And I think we can get around it in copyright, but it's tough to get around it in the context of street permitting.
Sure. Although you can imagine, since we do make these distinctions all the time, right? You can look at Sherry Levine's photographs of Walker Evans and Edward Weston's photographs and say they're completely distinct works.
Sure.
And so on. I mean that you might have trouble explaining to somebody who isn't tutored in the arts why that's valuable as art to be a perfect copy, but you know the idea itself is relatively intelligible to anyone. So maybe the administration of arts should encompass this kind of thing. After all, we do have like these forgery units now in the police departments, right? That are highly sophisticated.
Sure, and the IRS, you know, has a whole committee that evaluates art. We do it all the time. I guess that's the deeper answer in some ways is your worry is a profound one, and I want to know in what context is it mattering? I mean, I know what you're talking about, but like, if it matters in the sense that by not being recognized as art, it somehow were censored, then that would be deeply troubling. If we were censoring the most important, the most interesting art of our time because it's not recognized as such. If it means that it's not being subsidized, that's a different issue. If it means, and that's, you know, and subsidies extend to tax exemptions and tariff exemptions and things like that. If it means that somebody in an appropriation art context has to pay for their materials, which gets us closer to Warhol, then I'm not entirely sure what to say about that. You know, artists do have to pay for their materials.
Well, I mean, the Meta Perkins case, not to dwell on it, is a case where the Hermes prevented an artist, in fact, you know, made the artist get $150,000 because they made a picture of a Hermes bag. That was just argued at the Second Circuit. But there's a real case, and it's not the only one, where art was prevented from being made, where a giant multinational stomped on an artist because Judge Rakoff refused to acknowledge the possibility of something called business art or anything except the theft of trademark.
Yeah.
Oh,
not denying the stakes at all. I think that's a stupid opinion. Like that's a stupid result because it doesn't mostly because it doesn't take account of a kind of factor four. You know, not to get in the weeds, but like a fair use analysis. So like these are just different markets. That's the difference from Warhol, in my opinion. That those were not different markets. I think. And but what you just described absolutely are, and so of course, why should that not be fair use? But that's a separate question from saying, you know, I can say what I just said without having to recognize as a newly protected medium business art. Now, business art might become a thing that we all come to care very deeply about and comes to be a traditional medium of expression for the expression of ideas. That's an open-ended concept, what the protected mediums will be. But I don't think we need that here in order to give the protection that you want in that case.
Jeff.
I'm going to save poetry and architecture. Which is it right to say of the analysis that you gave of street selling that it's not enough just to exhibit the work on the sidewalk because the selling of it itself is expressive.
Yeah, great. So I might have been not entirely precise on that. The selling of expressive material had previously been protected. So it's not just that you have a right to publish the New York Times, there's also a right to sell, you know, you have a right to sell your expressive material as well. So that was established, you know, same with Hare Krishna cases, things like, you know, there's lots of contexts in which there's money going on, but for expressive activity. This was a slightly different claim that the, because they were also allowed to sell their art elsewhere, it was the streetness of it, right? It was that this was happening on the street is what made galleries and internet sales not an adequate alternative for expression. So I don't think they were here making the Citizens United money as speech kind of, I don't think that's, in some ways that step was prior. But that's not always very precisely dealt with in these cases, I would say. So, you know, that I'm not saying you're confused about it, but there's some blurriness in the cases.
So you can think of cases in the art world, like Damien Hirst, was Calvin Tompkins, who said the market is his medium.
Yeah.
And the skull encrusted in diamonds, things like that, you know, and putting it up for auction and buying it himself with his dealer and things like that, you know. This, all these financial transactions are part of the artistic work,
yeah.
Right? And they're expressive of something, mm-hmm. right? Maybe our fallen state. And so I could see how the Citizens United, people, you know, saying that essentially the dollar's speech, I could see how they could make an analogy to the Hearst-type work, where it's the fact that you're spending money in favor of this candidate or this social program or whatever. That
we have
matters.
To be a little careful there because it's political donations that are speech.
Mm-hmm.
And in
the donation itself.
Yeah, because this is where the slippage can be very harmful, because if it's money is speech, which I know I just said, when we're not precise about it, as I just wasn't, what we end up doing is saying that all commercial transactions are expressive, which means there's no more public accommodations laws.
Right.
You know, you don't have to sell to black people if you don't want to. You don't have to sell to gays because selling is expressive.
Right.
You know, and that is very frequently claimed. You know, that was the leading claim in the 60s, post-Civil Rights Act, and it was just roundly rejected. You know, no, that's not going to be free speech. And notice there's a circularity to that claim, too, because if you allow that people can exempt themselves from selling their food to letting black people go to their restaurant or hotel, then the choice to let black people into your restaurant or hotel actually does become expressive, because it's a choice that you have to make. Whereas if you just say public accommodations law, you can't do that. That's no longer expressive when there's a black person in your hotel anymore. And so, you know, it's not just a static thing. And so I do think that something like a medium, you know, that political donations have been seen as First Amendment protected speech. But we don't want to then just say that any financial transaction can then be that way.
And that goes to a larger point that you've made, which is that unless there are constraints and criteria for what counts as genuinely expressive, then A, we lose the expressive potential of those things we call art or expression, right? Because then everything's expressive, so nothing's expressive, right? Or, then we just, it's just a world we live in. And two, it's really hard to protect the things we really care about that really have value to us as expression, right? If we treat everything that one does.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as I say here, like, it's not an exemption if everybody gets it.
Yeah.
And related to the point that I was fumbling around a second ago with you is, looking at the context in which these claims are made is important, because often the time when the government is involved in deciding what's art or not is in a context where it's the artists who have said, give us a tax exemption, give us a tariff exemption, give us a subsidy. And you actually can't get an arts exemption from tax without giving the government the power to decide what arts are going to count for the exemption.
And that's a real concern, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ask for this protection, and what it means is then you're protected the way you might be protected by the mob, you know?
You've handed over some serious power there. Jen, you know, is supposed to be here with us today, and I have written this piece Sina mentioned that's coming out next year that's a deep dive into federal admissions taxes of the 20th century, which were in place from 1917 to 1965. There's a federal tax on admissions to cabarets and things like this. Just devastated the cabaret industry, especially during World War II. And, you know, but we are looking at, we start with this controversy that happened in Chicago just a couple years ago, where they have a descendant of that. They have a tax exemption for admissions to small venues, small arts venues. And suddenly they weren't giving it to venues that played rock and hip hop and country. They were giving it to classical venues. And they said, no, this isn't, because it said the fine arts in their ordinance. And the world just blew up. I mean, Rolling Stone was writing about this at the time. And the headlines were outraged. It's, you know, the tax man should not be an art critic, it was saying. But it's like, you're there asking for a tax exemption, right? You are making the tax man an art critic. And we can find more neutral ways to say, let's just give it small venues. But you know what ended up happening there? The DJs who brought the case ended up getting protected. But now there is a 6-factor test in Cook County for how you qualify as a DJ. And it involves things like you've got a manager, you're on the poster, people at the venue spend a significant amount of time looking at you rather than attending to other amusements. You know, it's the exact same thing that happened actually in this historical story to jazz, where because there was an exemption for jazz, if there was no singing and no dancing, you wouldn't get the cabaret tax. And what suddenly, bebop clubs were tax-free in Midtown Manhattan, right? The big dance halls closed. It's serious, like it's real power. This isn't just theoretical, is real power that you hand over. To his great credit, Robert Lederman, who did not want to give the city an additional way to judge who's an artist, I think was motivated by something like this. I think the result has been quite bad for the city, but you know, I have to hand it, he was both consistent in his argument about the visual arts should be treated like written material, and he had a real concern about giving the city that kind of power.
It's funny, because there's always this problem of, it's fascinating, this problem of defending the arts, typically because we think they have some special values, and maybe there's sweet generous value, or, you know, this value qua art, or the autonomy of art, or what have you, you know. And yet, in defending it, since those terms all sound very woo-woo, and, you know, it's hard to actually explain that, right, what we try to do is assimilate it to other things, like ordinary expression, right? We say, it'll give you that, it'll educate you, right? Or it'll be good for your morals, or what have you. Right, and that's always, it seems to me at least, it sort of wins the battle but loses the war, right? And that was, you know, in the Mapplethorpe case, right? Jenna Cardin, I guess, stood up and she points to Mapplethorpe's, you know, photos of him with a bull whip in his anus, and the prosecutor in Cincinnati says, you know, honey, because he's, you know, Cincinnatians. Whatever. Tell me what this shows. And all he had to do, he thought, was to get her to describe what the image shows. And then he, the director, Dennis Berry, would be convicted of pandering. And she says, oh, That's what we call a bullseye motif. It's a very formalist composition, right?
Right.
And the one of the, I forget the name, but one figure urinating into the mouth of another is a figure study. Right.
With a strong diagonal, or something.
Yeah, right. And so you save the art by appealing to these kinds of things, but you lose really what made it worth defending or important to defend in the first place,
It is interesting. There's less of that here in a funny way that there is less of the moral uplift. The tax story is a story of moral people competing to. Okay, you've exempted this. There's now been an exemption for symphony. We too are as morally uplifting as the symphony. And we're the drama and we're not the burlesque. But now you have to define drama. And there's a committee of people, there's a Yale drama professor who comes and says, well, it's at least an hour and 45 minutes and it has multiple acts and a single plot that develops over. Seriously? You talk about something being just regressive, right? And it's in order to get a tax exemption. So that's why I'm always very focused on what's the context in which, what's at stake, in making these judgments. I see less of the moral uplift here in an interesting kind of way.
It's sort of taken for granted that it's valuable, the arts.
Maybe it's the fact that we already, here in New York, we're already giving an exemption for written matter. And most of that's crap.
Right.
So I don't think anybody is actually coming into this case in 1994 assuming that to get an exemption from the permitting scheme, this has to be morally uplifting. They've all seen what books and magazines are sold. So maybe that's part of it, too.
It just seems weird that there's all sorts of, the sale of anything is normally permitting. Yeah. Why shouldn't it be for books? I mean, what seems weird is that there's any exemption at all. Right, commerce is usually regulated. Galleries are regulated, sort of daily sometimes. It just seems weird that there are any exemptions. It should just be normal business regulation. You can, it seems weird that there's even regulated that there might not be regulation for books.
Yeah, I think the problem there. I'm not unsympathetic to that, but I think the problem there is when we smooth out the distinction between expressive matter and non-expressive matter, the way that smoothing out has moved in recent years is to bring everything into the First Amendment in our current Supreme Court, as opposed to saying, let's regulate everything. It's been a very imperialist First Amendment that's treated treated pharmaceutical prescriptions and things as a form of expression. And so, not that it has to be that way, but that is the current concern. New York's more recent attempts to regulate expression in places like the High Line or Union Square have been an expressive matter category that doesn't do medium at all. And then it's just a first, it's a rush to get one of those little medallion spots. If you ever look down at the High Line or at Union Square, there's little medallions in the concrete. And those are spots where somebody who does expressive matter can set up if they're first there.
Interesting. How do you define expressive matter? It seems to be hugely problematic.
Yeah, so it's not a pashmina shawl, right? I know, we're going to get back to your... We're going to get back to...
Totally incoherent.
And yet our First Amendment edifice is built on that. It's... The First Amendment struggles. A First Amendment that cares about art struggles with an art world in which anything can be a work of art.
But that's actually a more normal art world, in fact.
No, I realize that is art. I realize that.
But in the entire history of human making, the idea that there's this separate category called fine art is a very bizarre invention around 1500 Europe.
Sure, but it hasn't always been a fine art distinction, but it's the idea that there are objects that are representation, objects that are meaning-bearing, that have aboutness. I'm going all Danto here. Objects that have aboutness and objects that don't. And...
They have what?
Aboutness.
They have content.
They have content. That there are some, that do and some that, that don't, and if that's the distinction ultimately. So sure, there are some Pashmina shawls that are about something, but most of the ones sold on the street are not. They're
just like
tools.
Those paintings sold in Chelsea.
Well, that's absolutely the claim about the move from photographers to photographs. Not that all photographers were doing highly expressive things, but a much higher, I would say the hit rate is much higher than when somebody can sell any mass-produced thing as long as it is a photograph.
Like of the Statue of Liberty.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think, I don't know if this study has been done. Lord knows I didn't do it. But I think if we did a empirical study of what's sold on New York City streets, it would be overwhelmingly mass-produced, right?
Yeah.
It's also just an interesting question. Given that the work you're talking about because it poses this problem. If that problem were then solved either by the work or by the institutions that that's structured, would it still be art?
That's exactly that's a really good question. Like so business art became accepted by all the courts.
Right.
Interesting might be to sell a diamond covered.
Sure. But yeah, no, I mean, that's a problem not unlike, for example, civil disobedience. It's not the case that you necessarily want immediate acceptance in legal category. That would give the arts far less to play with and play off of.
I really do believe that automatically accepting all painting does just as much harm. It creates a really false notion of what art should be. I really think it's pretty much equal in the harm it does. Denying the possibility of business art, for instance, of Damien Hirst's skull in its sale as art. And I really do think that it creates an assumption that certain media are expressive when they aren't.
Good. So I think that the uptake of, let's say, painting as a medium that gets protection from law is significantly based on its historical role in conveying ideas. That's what gets talked about mostly, and that's certainly. But I think what gets undersold in that is the extent to which it's pretty solidly expressive all the way through. Painting is. I'm just saying that the traditional concept of painting is. Doesn't have the kinds of harms that buildings do, that cakes do, that food. It's a pretty it's suffused with expression in a way that more provocative recent experiments with medium tend to be a little more suffused with their objecthood. That is the kind of objecthood that the law wants to regulate.
I think you're wrong in the matter of art history, but that's something we could discuss.
So I don't think that traditionally the legal actors have had a ton of interest regulating canvas. In the sense of like that they're worried about canvas harms. That's my poetry point.
Okay. So you can make the distinction between the object and the work. Art. The object is the thing the work is made with or of, and so on. And you're saying that when it comes to paintings, there hasn't been much of a legal interest or even concern or need to regulate canvas and stretchers and things like that. But when it comes to architecture, we're talking about artistic architecture, right? Or cakes, or something like that.
Abercrombie stores.
Or stores that claim themselves to be theatrical experiences, that the law must have an interest in their objecthood, in the constituents of them, because that's where a lot of bad things happen.
There's a lot of non-expressive stuff there that the law is probably right to have its eye on when it comes to
like excluding people with certain color of skin.
When it comes to stores, cakes, etc., and some newfangled media of expression. And so I think the traditional ones are in part traditional mediums of expression, both because we've used them for a long time to communicate, but also because it's really, like, in traditional, in old-fashioned painting, I agree, the vast majority of it is worthless. I mean, just think, you know, most of it is made by people like me or something, right? You know, it's made by kindergartners, it's made by kids in art class. Like, it's not, it doesn't have communicative value, but it's also harmless in the sense of, in the material sense, that it's harmless in the sense that is relevant to the government, because the government should not be caring about expressive harms. That's the First Amendment. The government can't be regulating the expressivity of it. What they can be regulating is the objects, the material harms of it. And those are just thicker in certain mediums than others.
That's almost an ethical argument to ban appropriation of business art or, you know, limited innocuous protection. That's not. I mean, I agree with you with architecture. There are issues.
I think it is an appropriation. In a genuine claim in appropriation art where someone feels as if they've been stolen from because they have relevantly similar markets, where the market of the appropriated, you know, demolished their market. I think they are making that kind of claim. I just think that courts are bad at it, and so often they're doing what you just described, which, you know, it's just a corporation being a landlord. But done well, I think that there's that distinction. Yeah, there was that. I'm forgetting the exact. So in 82, when they added it, they had a funny kind of euphemism for it. The city council did. Let's see if I have it here. In their sort of statement of purpose, when they changed the vending law to exempt written material, they said that the city council decided this exemption was, quote, consistent with the principles of free speech and freedom of the press. Consistent. And in the book I say, this exemption was, quote, consistent with, unquote, a euphemism for compelled by. And what you're saying is, maybe I'm wrong on that. Maybe it's not compelled by.
Because it's these books are available elsewhere.
Yeah, because people could sell.
And there wasn't anything
sell elsewhere.
Particularly expressive about selling them on the street versus.
Yeah, you know, the freedom of the press, there is a very strong tradition, historical tradition, of selling papers and pamphlets that I think, especially in our current judicial context, would get a lot of uptick. You know, that people would be responsive to that kind of argument that, at the time of the founding, people really cared about being able to sell pamphlets. And of course, this is the argument why the business improvement districts said, you all are freeloaders who just don't want to pay taxes and rent. You know, you're selling the same stuff we are, just out there on the street. You know, it was the city councilwoman in Soho that was leading the charge here for the arrests, saying, you know, I'm protecting the gallerists. These artists are out there just taking their business.
I remember the Strand used to operate sort of book stalls up near Central Park, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
That seems like that would be kind of an inversion. I mean, what's to stop, you know, Larry Cagosi from setting up a stall on
Yeah, nothing as far as I know. I mean.
Are depriving them of their opportunities, then, you know, what happens when they start making use of those same opportunities? And,
yeah.
Well, so now increasingly, yes. At the time, probably no. Robert Lederman, as I told you, I'm on his listserv. And so one thing that I've learned a lot from his advocacy in all these years is he makes some pretty convincing arguments about the business improvement districts and the way the methods they've engaged in to try to reduce the scope of this victory. And in some ways, they've done it by beautification projects, planters, things like that, you know, hostile architecture, as we say, right? You know, things that are out there because lots of city ordinances which are completely content neutral would say you have to be X number of feet from certain structures. Mm-hmm. So they just make more structures and reduce the footprint that's available to artists and other vendors. The other thing that we all see it, are things like Christmas markets and different markets where they take over these spaces for the Christmas season, and all of those spots are sold. Right, so they will do things that are marketed as we're going to have an art fair, but it's an art fair that takes up all of the city's street spaces, that sidewalk spaces that would have otherwise gone to artists and veterans. None of them have a right to that particular spot. So I think they would probably have a challenge at the outset of the property claim. You know, taking is a taking of property, and I think that wouldn't count as constitutional property. But I'm speaking a little bit beyond my expertise there. That's my guess, is where the problem would be there. Yeah, because there, I mean, you know, a taking has to be compensated, and who would you compensate? Yeah, please. Places outside of New York, or
Just in your research scope, what kind of quantitative?
Do I think that artists normally win in their exemption claims? Oh, great! Yeah, no. No, I don't. I think no. You know, the even in the most recent cases in the discrimination context, 303 Creative, the website case, the most recent, was a bit of a departure because you might remember the wedding cake case, they ended up dodging the First Amendment question entirely and said that there was religious discrimination against him in the proceedings in the state court. And so they spent their entire time talking about the free speech question and, in fact, the art question. All of the first questions of the Supreme Court were about, is this an artwork or not? Lots of questions like, well, you know, I have a, who cuts your hair? There's like Subway trains people to be sandwich artists. So there are lots of questions about that. You know, there was just all sorts of hypotheticals. But then they dodged it in the opinion. So normally people find either they lose or find another way for them to win that's not based on recognizing something as art. And they never said in the website case that it was art. It was just a very particular type of expression, a very customized kind of expression, which may or may not be true of what that person was actually or will actually do. But, you know, That's what the exemption was for, a very customized form of expression. So, yeah, generalized art claims, I argue, just are almost never winners. Yeah. The corporation angle is now, though, coming to the fore. So I don't know if you've seen Disney fired. It's not a show I watch, but maybe it's Mandalorian or something like that. They fired an actress because of her political views.
Yeah,
she sued because it's California and we have political discrimination as a viable claim. And they said, arts. You know, we have to be able to craft the expressive show that we want. Just as people often make, you know, just as Lin-Manuel Miranda can cast people of color as the founding fathers and not have a white George Washington,
that's great.
So too can we. And you know, that's the front lines of
And what's great about that is that that's a clear case in which you need to say, look, we can distinguish what belongs to the work of art and what is merely the object.
Exactly.
Whereas, like, obviously in Hamilton, that the actors are black and the singers are black is part of the meaning of the work.
That's right.
But it's hard to think of a Star Wars film having anything to do with the actual person who plays the role.
That's right, because because the star is, you know, secretly voting for Trump on the side or something,
right? Yeah. Right. There can be works like that, of course, but
what Hermes was claiming, part of what Hermes was claiming in the Metaverse space is that he preemptively stole in something they might eventually want to create as well.
Oh,
right.
Sure.
That was part of the claim, that they might go on to want to make something look just like what he made, and therefore the fact that he's made it had not prevented them from making it.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be a winning claim.
Yeah, that's, I know. Right?
Yeah. I have an idea.
Yeah. No more books in the series.
Sorry.
Exactly. Great. Well, thank you. Oh, yeah, please. So wait, we've got one more question. Yeah. As a factual matter, I don't know if it would have won over Judge Cabranes. He seemed quite hostile to the claim. But it's a factor that was clearly determinative in Barry. And so it should have been at least considered in Master of Vincenzo if they had raised it. But by not raising it, they waive it. So... Hard to say. Lederman, now we're in conspiracy. Lederman thinks that the Street Vendors Project is under the sway of the Business Improvements District. So he very much distances himself from the later case as thinking they don't really care about art at all. They're just, you know, they have their own agenda. I don't know nearly enough about anything to know whether that's true, but I will. What I do know is that that was a decisive claim in the first case and just is not present, which is strange because you read the first case and a good lawyer should see that that's a thing that mattered to the court, that made a difference in the judgment in the first case. So it would be very strange to not raise it, especially when your artists are, you know, have a background of street artists. Well, they are on it. This was on appeal. They didn't raise it. Yeah. Mm. Yep. Yeah, this just was not. That's right. If they had raised it below, they would probably be precluded from raising it on appeal. But they didn't raise it anywhere. It's not in the briefs. And it's a subtle argument. You know, you could see how people that are. You could see how the street vending project, or whatever it's called, it would be a foreign concept to them because they're representing mostly food vendors, where that's not how they think of, you know, the selling my falafel on the street isn't part of the meaning of my, you know, that's not, the streetness isn't part of the project in the same way, most likely. Obviously, there could be some for whom that is the case. Obviously, street food is a thing, I realize, you know, but not, you know, not across the board. people want a good place to sell where there's going to be lots of workers coming out at lunch. And so you could see how, if that's your world, like I represent those people day in, day out, that this wouldn't be in mind in a way that for an ACLU lawyer or an artist rights project kind of lawyer, it really was.
Yeah, they did.
Well, you have to find a lawyer. You know, you have to pay for it. So you get who you can afford. Okay, we'll see if we need a lawyer. I'm still barred in New York, so. Yep. Yeah, thank you all for coming.